Hey everybody, welcome back to the MMA Vivisection with me, Zane Simon, my co-host, as always, Connor Rebush.
That's me! I could have done that for longer. I was
That's merciful. Right. I should really been on cue to like then speed talk my way through the rest of it. We're here talking about UFC 299 going down at Miami, Florida, Kaseya Center.
Wow.
Anyway. It's
a professional operation.
Yeah. It's a level of professionalism that, kept bloody elbow alive and kicking.
No wonder our fucking website failed.
Oh yes, if you're listening to this and have not heard the news, the .com is no more. We are still
technically it still exists. It
is, yes,
indistinguishable from a dozen other AI generated websites
out there. Yeah, it's a content mill. It's a sad day, but you know, I'm just gonna say, at least for my own part, this is nothing that I didn't see coming on the horizon as a potential occurrence.
Could have warned me.
And, well, you know.
You did.
I did. Yeah. And I'm a little broken up about it because it's a lot of work that we all put out there. But I'm also, worked a lot of 7-day, like 10 hours a day weeks last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an impossibly hard venture from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to pretend that I went into this all naive and, Pollyanna, that I didn't think that we were trying to do a lot of work to save something that probably wouldn't succeed. So I'm not
going to. That was a lot of syllables to get into a word with me still thinking you were in the process of saying polyamorous.
Yes, a naive polyamorous situation. I've taken multiple lovers over my time at Bloody Elbow.
I was on the hook for about the 7th letter of that word. That was crazy.
You thought all the way through, you were thinking, is it polyanorous? Have I been saying it? I've been saying it wrong all this time.
So whatever the current unstable future of this show's platform, we're going to keep doing the show basically, yeah, as long as we're able, I think.
Yep. One way or another, come hell or high water, the Vivisection will live on. If we have to change the name, but we're going to do the show.
Shit. Maybe we should change the name. It's not a good name.
It is not a good name. It's much true. Much
like Bloody Elbow itself, the name is sort of like, ooh, I'm stuck with this.
Yeah.
I got to think about people cutting off a dog's living head just so I can enjoy some MMA fight predictions. Vivisection.
Well, in the interests of getting a really good name, I'm thinking I'll just tie up right now MMA fight show, and that'll be our new brand.
Now that's good. That's got punch to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, MMA fight podcast.
No, just show. Could be a podcast, could be a webcast, could be an anything.
That's good. Now that's SEO, baby.
None of this screwing around with like weird, punk sort of.
No, we're done with that. We're becoming corporate shills now.
Yeah.
Got to adapt to the times, folks. This is the streamlined MMA fight show.
That's right. Brought to you by Zients and Mickey's Malt Liquor.
Yeah.
Only the best.
I miss the days when the UFC used to be sponsored by products no one had ever heard of.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
Okay.
We should see if Condom Depot is still kicking around.
I'll check right now.
get them to sponsor the show. That would be sick.
That would actually be awesome.
I would happily sell condoms to our lovely audience.
They are still around.
Yes. Send an email. Let's get it going.
Let's see. Do they have a info? Contact us.
Let's do it.
Create a support ticket. No, they have a phone number. But they have a form to fill out with email. Let's see. Full nice. Name, Zane, Dottie. No, Zane, Simon.
I'm just Googling dynamic fastener. Hold on.
Seven, six. Email address, ZaneSimon@gmail.com. Company name, MMA Fight Show.
You actually got it.
Comments, questions.
Zane, we cannot call it MMA Fight Show. We can't do that. Condom Depot, I'm genuinely on board for the title. I got to be honest. I don't think it stands out. I don't know how else to say it.
Well, for now, it's MMA Fight. For the purposes of this email that I'm sending, it's MMA Fight Show.
You send them in the first follow-up email. Actually, we've changed the name to something horrible and discomforting.
Here, I'll put MMA Vivi just for you.
There we go.
Would you be interested in sponsoring our long-running MMA podcast hosted by me, Zane Simon, alongside my trained monkey?
Now that I don't have a problem with, make sure that they know that we're both childless. Which makes us natural advocates for prophylactics.
Right. Neither of us have kids. Of us have kids, making us a natural fit for your product.
Parentheses, my co-host is in fact impotent, but that's besides the point.
No. I don't want to sour what's already a really good email. Let's see. I have to go through a captcha. Let's see. Selecting cars, pictures of cars.
Okay.
Verify.
Are they cool cars?
All right.
Any cyber trucks in there? Is that a car? No, that's a car.
I have submitted the form.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah,
Condom Depot. Hopes.
Back in the game.
Tell them we have an elastic business model.
Okay, we're here to talk about UFC 299 going down at the Kaseya Center in Miami, Florida.
That's right.
Headlined by a bantamweight title fight, Sean O'Malley versus Marlon Vera. And it's just a good card, up and down.
Yep.
Great card.
Yep.
Probably should have saved some of this for UFC 300, if we're being honest.
You know, what is the main event of 300 after all? What did it turn out to be?
It turned out to be Jamal Hill versus Alex Pereira.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, you rob Peter to pay Paul, right? Like, do I really want this pay-per-view not to be awesome so that 300 can be slightly more awesome? I would like it. I mean, 300 means nothing to me. It's the UFC's stupid decision.
So what I will say is, and I made a rant about this before in writing back when we had a website, that these days, the UFC is in like the content business more than ever.
Of course.
And they have drained interest in their fight nights by clearly diluting the product.
Yeah, drained it all into a sort of a reservoir tip.
Yeah. Brought to you by Condom Diva. And the pay-per-views, some of them have gotten better. But there's still a little bit of a fuzzy, like,
yeah,
we could change things up at any moment. It's getting harder for the UFC to book well because fighters are realizing that they need to hold out more.
Mm-hmm.
And so the UFC really, but they don't have a lot of guarantees these days, it feels like, that you're going to absolutely get a really good show.
Yeah.
But the Centennial shows and International Fight Week, those are supposed to be the guarantees, you know?
I don't even think they do International Fight Week anymore.
Yeah, they do. They do.
Do they?
Yeah, they don't do the Expo that they used to do.
Okay.
But they still do or if they do an Expo, it's not nearly the same thing that they used to do. It used to be tied to a big, huge Expo event. Now it's just like there's some fan meet and greet stuff and a fight card at the end of it, you know. But and the Hall of Fame ceremony every year is tied to International Fight Week. I think they used to do they had the IMMAF doing like an amateur world championships during International Fight Week too.
It would be cool if it was just like an Arnold Classic,
Yeah, it was a whole thing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, those are the two shows, that we as fans are supposed to be able to get the guarantee from the UFC. They are going to try whatever they can to put on the biggest fight card possible. So when they flub it, it does drive home more and more that like it is getting more difficult for them to actually book and create big special cards. That said, UFC 299 is a great card. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to pretend they got this one wrong. This is great.
Nope. I like it.
If you're gonna rob your fight nights, at the very least, I want this out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And our headliner, Sean O'Malley, Marlon Vera, should be a really good, fascinating fight.
Yeah, it has to be said, probably not the most deserving title fight in a pure sporting sense. Not that the UFC or combat sports at large has ever really been beholden to that.
No.
It's the grudge match that Sean O'Malley wanted. They probably have determined that is just automatically like that is something to maybe sell it on. Whereas like, what are you going to sell Corey Sandhagen on? The fact that he's like the best guy in the division?
Yeah.
No one cares about that.
No.
So, yeah, you know, you could argue, but I still like the fight, you know, whatever.
It's a good fight.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fun fight the first time they did it.
Well, not much really happened.
Well, it was interesting, at least. It was an interesting style clash. It was warming up as an interesting fight.
And it has a story. I mean, that adds interest right there. That it ended in a, you know, quote-unquote controversial way.
Yeah.
And that there's been all this, like, refusal to accept the result as it was from Sean O'Malley. And
yep.
Yeah, Chito Vera's got a chip on his shoulder about it because he feels he should get full credit for that. I think probably rightfully. Mm-hmm. It's cool. I like it.
Yeah.
Happy to see it.
And the card underneath it is great.
Yep.
Yeah.
No argument there.
So let's get into it. Let's talk Sean O'Malley, Marlon Vera, and what feels like they're... This fight feels like a very unknown fight to me, honestly.
Really? Not to me.
No?
What? No.
Talk about it then.
I feel I actually have a shockingly straightforward read on this fight.
Yeah.
More so than the vast majority of matchups. It comes down to the very simple fact that not only does Sean O'Malley appear to be sort of just physically fragile.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a good chin. That's obvious.
Yeah, great chin.
guy can take a shot. He's very tough mentally. You know, he can get like really tired and kind of beat up and still hang in there doing good work. Like he, this is not me calling him weak or anything.
No.
But, you know, pieces of him fly off. His body durability is not at the level of certain elite athletes. And in particular, that has reared its head as a problem with leg kicks. So leg kicks hurt him more than they do a lot of fighters. And that combines with the fact that leg kicks directly attack the very principled positional boxing game, the jab-based boxing game that makes him click as a striker at the feet. So that's it to me, honestly.
Yeah.
It is literally the it's the thing that decided their first fight. It appeared to be a pretty decisive factor against a not particularly good-looking version of Pedro Munhoz when Sean O'Malley fought him. It was nearly a decisive factor way back when Sean O'Malley fought Andre Sukumtat.
Yeah, yeah.
And got his leg ripped off and barely survived that fight. And yeah, well, but you know, that one is one where it sort of appeared late in the fight, yada, yada. What you really saw in Munhoz and Vera fights is that not only do those leg kicks have an obvious effect that Sean O'Malley just doesn't absorb them that well, but he couldn't get going because of the effect the leg kicks were having. That's the problem. Sean O'Malley's game works because he has a good jab and he uses it positionally. He adjusts his feet to keep that jab online. It's what makes him really difficult to chase compared to almost every other fighter in the UFC who attempts to fight off the back foot. O'Malley is just better at it than most of them.
Yeah.
By a good margin. And it's because he keeps that active threat as something to actually enforce his defensive movement. So you have to respect it when he changes an angle because it's never purely defensive. That's the heart and soul of positional boxing right there. And yeah, low kicks are just a great way to attack that little angle that he's constantly chasing.
Yeah.
And I think thus far we have seen him come up with one solution to this being a problem. It was against Piotr Jan, who, not with a ton of diligence, not the way I expect Cheeto to, but did try to attack the legs. And O'Malley's solution in that fight was to constantly change stance.
Yeah.
Classic MMA overcorrection. But to his credit, he's actually pretty good out of both stances. His jab still functions. Like he's a lead hand fighter, whether he's southpaw or orthodox.
Yeah.
You know, has an educated lead in both stances. So his game still works. But basically, like this brings the how you call this fight down to me to a couple of pretty simple questions, which is like, first of all, can Sean O'Malley knock Chito Vera out before this becomes a real problem?
Yeah, that is.
Seems unlikely.
Seems unlikely. Chito Vera has pretty much the best chin in MMA. If it's not the best, it's tied for the best.
Exactly. Yeah, he has a granite chin. The only factor that might change that is the fact that Sean O'Malley is very accurate and very hard hitting.
Yeah.
You know, like he is above average in those departments, but Cheeto is literally like the pinnacle of durability. So it seems unlikely. And then the other thing is this another fight where Sean O'Malley can rise to the occasion and make one or two solid adjustments? Like, can he check kicks?
Yeah.
Has he spent the last year working on leg conditioning and practicing his reactions to actually check kicks? Because if he has, you can. It's not like being a boxer means that you have to eat low kicks.
No.
There's a million Muay Thai fighters. There's fewer today, but in like the golden age of Muay Thai, those dudes had to worry about low kicks. There's a million of those guys that are really good boxers.
Yep.
You think Sanchai, his boxing like falls apart because he has to worry about low kicks? You think Samart Payakarun, who was like a legitimate world champion level boxer, you think his boxing didn't exist when he was fighting Muay Thai and he had to worry about low kicks? No. It's one of those things. It's like saying that you can't stop takedowns from a boxing stance. Untrue. Yeah. What you need is to learn to wrestle.
Yeah.
And just have the timing right so you can sort of switch modes and react accordingly. You can have a more of a boxing stance and you can use boxers' angles, which everybody should be doing anyway, and just be ready to lift the leg at the right time and stop a low kick.
Mm-hmm.
So if he's learned that, I basically have no reason to expect Chito Vera to come up with any kind of meaningful adjustment.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what makes this difficult for me is, I mean, the low kicks are obviously a huge factor and an easy read, but it's also just like Marlon Vera doesn't really feel to me like a fighter who has a style to win a title, really. You know,
he doesn't have a style to win rounds unless he
exactly
does crippling damage.
Yeah,
which works a lot more than you'd expect. But
yeah, we've talked about him with the Yoel Romero comparison a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he's a lot of him is that guy. Just, you know, A, that didn't win Yoel Romero a championship either. You can argue it should have, but it didn't. And B, he is not the athlete Yoel Romero is. No. He has the power, but just like, you know, he's also a guy that can be and has been throughout his career out-wrestled.
Yeah.
You know?
Get the power and the durability.
Yeah.
Both things that Romero also had, but
yeah. He's not a actual, like, you know, forest demon that
right.
could, like, he is basically built like the Beast from X-Men, you know?
Right. Yeah. He doesn't have the Bane juice pumping through his veins. So
I will always...
And I'm not saying it makes it an easy prediction, because I still think there's a good case that it could go either way. But to me, the question of the fight is quite simple. It's,
Can
Sean O'Malley, has he developed a way to deal with that? Because if not, Chito would have to be like truly an unprecedented level of insane not to just hammer the legs as often as he can.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting that like in their first fight, O'Malley did start out winning the low kick battle.
Sure.
You know,
mm-hmm.
But of course it is also interesting that it did not take a lot of Vera giving it back to him for him to lose it.
No, he just doesn't have the same kind of durability.
Yeah.
And his game relies more on the specific things that the low kicks sort of attack conceptually.
Yeah.
That's it.
The other reservations I have, which are largely, you know, so the first reservation I have here for Sean O'Malley, outside of just the pure durability, whether it's legs or, you know, does he have the chin Marlon Vera does? I don't know. He's got a good chin.
He clearly and recovers well. Yeah.
And recovers well. But I, you know, it also feels like I've seen him get hurt to a greater degree than I see Marlon Vera get hurt, even when I see Marlon Vera get stung, you know?
Yeah.
Other question for me, honestly, too, out of this is, does Sean O'Malley have, if he can't get Marlon Vera out of there, and if Marlon Vera is able to do what he normally does, which is slowly turn up the pace and pressure, and that seems something that Sean O'Malley will probably give him, because O'Malley is very comfortable fighting off the back foot mm-hmm. and skirting the cage. Is O'Malley really actually ready to do that for five rounds?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's never had to. He has never fought a five-round fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Like, it is worth wondering, because I do have more faith that Marlon Vera, you put him in round four and five, and he is still exactly as dangerous and capable.
Yep.
So that is a question. The other question I have here is, though, I have seen O'Malley willing to wrestle a bit. And it is completely possible that he could take surprise, shock Marlon Vera and take him down. And put him on his back and win rounds doing it.
Yeah.
You know?
Maybe.
I mean, he... Yeah, I don't know. Like, yeah, Vera is just... He's never actually been credited with a takedown in the UFC except for when he fought Tarion Ware.
Mm-hmm.
Which is weird because I feel like I remember him on top in other fights. But maybe it's just all scramble reversing or hurting somebody first.
And probably they're not counting, like, maybe catching kicks and sweeping the leg as takedowns or something. Who knows?
Yeah. But, I mean, Vera is just not hard to take down. At least not early. He's hard later when he gets his momentum going.
His takedown defense isn't bad. It's just not bulletproof.
It's, well,
he just stands very tall and...
Yeah.
And early
on, he starts cold and wants to pressure a lot. And so he always falls into the cold starting pressure fighter's trap.
Yeah.
Of getting immediately countered, either getting knocked down, knocked over, or taken down.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess
and he throws a lot of kicks, which I think is part of the thing, too. He's a very kick heavy fighter. So there's just a lot more opportunities to time a good takedown.
Yeah, like Corey Sandhagen took him down 3 times, and Sandhagen is a decent wrestler.
But especially if we're concerned about O'Malley maybe not having the gas to be effective for 5 rounds, I'd be very hesitant to advise him to try to lean on wrestling, something
he
never really had to rely on.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, because we've talked, as we said before, Vera's also not a round winner. That's just not the way he fights. So what are the ways, you know, O'Malley's got his jab to work behind, and, you know, are there ways he can take rounds off Vera just through sheer stick-to-itiveness and work? And I could, you know, I can see arguments for him, like, taking rounds off of wrestling and taking rounds behind his jab, but... Yeah, I think every time I come back around to it, it is like, I don't know if Sean O'Malley can be pushed for 5 rounds, can get pushed in rounds 4 and 5 and respond. You know, it's not even like how much energy does he spend, but just when he gets that deep into a fight, mm-hmm. how well will he be able to, if Vera is just absolutely marching him down, how ready will he be to fight as hard out of that as he could early on? And then, yeah, the durability is the other big question that I've never had the cause to question it in Vera. So, yeah, I do feel like I have to take Marlon Vera here, but it is, you know, I guess my hesitancy comes from just Vera having a style that's just not made to win rounds at a very elite level.
His game just doesn't make sense. I mean,
yeah,
it simply doesn't.
Yeah.
But it's for me, it's a you know, if you're picking him, it's a styles make fights kind of thing.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, that it's very rare that a fight, especially one at this level, seems to have such a simplistic decisive factor. But to me, it's just the low kicks. Like if O'Malley comes out there and reveals that he has kind of learned a few different ways of dealing with them, even just one, then I don't really, again, I you can't trust Cheeto to like come up with a good mid-fight adjustment.
Yeah.
I think that would be more than enough. If you think he's going to do that, more than enough reason to pick him. And you got to consider that you probably, like me, like you, Zane, like Phil, you probably didn't think he would rise to the occasion and make the right moves against Piotr Jan.
No, I didn't.
And even if you still thought Jan won that fight, you got to give O'Malley full marks for an incredibly good performance.
Mm-hmm.
And what everybody assumed was a terrible style matchup. So there's reason to think that, yeah, O'Malley is like just he's not stupid enough to come into this fight and have it be the fourth one in his career where he just doesn't have an answer to the low kicks.
Yeah.
But it's also possible that his answer is not as good as he hopes it will be.
It could be, yeah. It could be that he'll come out and try to wrestle, and he'll take Vera down early, and he will get tired doing that.
Yeah. It could be that it's like the he thinks the stance switching he did against Jan is enough, and Chito just attacks both legs anyway.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work as well as he wanted it to. Or it could be he is an MMA fighter. It could simply be that this is just one of those things he still has not corrected.
Yeah.
Again, there have been 3 fights in his career where he has gotten fucked up by low kicks.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them featured him like even trying to stop the kicks. They seemed like a surprise every time.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm picking Chito, because
I do wonder if low kicks are not going to play as big a factor as we think. But even then, I just kind of have to look at like.
Yeah, there's a possibility Chito comes in with no game plan at all. Or if he does, like his coaches are screaming at him to do the obvious. And for whatever reason, he just doesn't. Like Chito's such a weird guy. Who knows what informs the decisions he makes in his fights?
But then I also have to think, okay, it's rounds 4 and 5. Who do I think is more capable of potentially finishing the fight late and like keeping the action high? And yeah, I trust Vera a little more on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It's just something that I've seen him do. He's had, you know, he has had 3 of his last 4 fights, I believe. Yeah, 3 of his last 4 fights have gone 4 or 5 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And like he knocked Dominic Cruz out with a head kick in round 4.
Mm-hmm.
You know? He brutalized Rob Font all the way through that fight.
Mm-hmm. Crushed poor Brad Pickett back in the day at the very end of round 3. He he's more than capable of messing somebody up way late into a fight.
Yeah. And so yeah, I have to pick Vera, but it is like he is so counter to the meta right now that it's very hard for me to trust my own like what my own eyes are telling me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Odds here, Sean O'Malley is the favorite, open at -182. He's currently at -266. Vera open at +163. He's currently at +229. All right, that brings me to a lightweight bout, Dustin Poirier, Benoit Saint-Denis. And this is a fight that, like, this has a very Volk Topuria feel to me, except on much less, more dramatic difference. I mean, Benoit Saint-Denis is not Ilya Topuria.
No, he's not. I know what you mean. It's a youth versus, yeah. I mean, I was staggered thinking about this yesterday when I was talking with Phil to look at the, just to realize that a fight like Poirier Korean Zombie,
mm-hmm.
that was like 12 years ago.
Yeah.
This dude has been having wars for like 14, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, just I thought he looked great in his last fight despite getting knocked out. But like Volk Topuria, it's like young, violent action fighter versus aging action fighter. Yeah.
Kind of. Somebody who is really confident in their ability to go forward and create damage.
Yeah.
You know, somebody just popped over on Twitter the like fighters with the highest knockdown ratio for this week's card.
Mm-hmm.
And Benoit Saint-Denis, he's the highest. You know, he's knocking people down at a higher rate than anybody. Now, well, you know, I was going to say that part of that is going to be that he just doesn't have that many fights in the UFC. But then I actually went and looked and he's already fought in the UFC 6 times. Like, that's not nothing. It's not Dustin Poirier's sample size, but he's not in, like, pure newcomer territory at that point, you know? He is he has proven himself to be a regularly violent guy. And on the flip side, Dustin Poirier is literally better at him than at everything. You know? Like, you watch Benoit Saint-Denis versus Matt Frivola, and there's a lot of Benoit Saint-Denis just sort of ineffectually charging at Frivola.
Yeah.
And desperately trying to track him down, getting hit on the counter, just like diving in on takedowns he can't get anywhere close to getting.
Yeah.
And then he catches a slapping head kick as Frivola exits the pocket and knocks him out, because he's always throwing when he's moving forward. And he just has absolute belief that he will make something happen.
Yeah. But I mean, Dustin, that fight with Zaleski wasn't that long ago.
No.
And there was a lot of that where he just got tuned up by a dude who was just a better boxer.
Yeah. But he also made that fight an absolute war for
every minute
of it.
Yeah. The question is, does Dustin Poirier lose wars, or does he lose because of like really well set up, well timed shots?
Yeah. And I think I'm picking Poirier here. Although, you know, you could also argue that like his fight with Charles Oliveira was a bit of a war, but.
Yeah, that's true. Fair enough.
But, mostly Poirier's problems, like, he wants the kind of fight that Benoit Saint-Denis is going to give him.
Mm-hmm.
Most of Poirier's problems over the years have been him having to come forward and just being a pretty defensively irresponsible fighter when he does.
Mm-hmm.
And his whole game is built around, has become built more and more around the understanding that he can fight at his best when he's falling out of the pocket. And he can create that opportunity by chasing somebody and then getting them to respond so he can drop back. Or he can create that opportunity by waiting on somebody and letting them be aggressive and come to him. But he's at his best when he's slipping and moving on the back foot,
mm-hmm.
and has got somebody going after him with combinations. And I think the big thing that we saw in that fight with Justin Gaethje that made it such a good fight for Gaethje was Gaethje didn't chase. He would go out and throw one or two or three strikes at Poirier, and Poirier would slide back and he just would stop,
mm-hmm.
and be like, no, you have to come to me and create the kind of offense that leaves you vulnerable again, over and over. I'm not going to come. He's not going to do what he did the first time, which was to pressure Poirier relentlessly and find that Poirier could always slide away and find an angle to land one last shot as Gaethje would come forward. And I think that Benoit Saint-Denis is going to give Poirier that first Justin Gaethje fight.
Yep.
Which that was an awesomely violent fight that gave plenty of opportunities for Gaethje to win it. But it was a fight that Gaethje could never really quite find the point to turn the momentum where he would stop getting hit harder last. So I'm going
to. It was also one where like half the reason, more than half the reason that it was as nip-tuck as it was Gaethje's insistence on hammering Poirier's legs.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Denis is incapable, but it's not really like Gaethje's known for that.
Yeah. Saint-Denis is at heart a swing and cling artist, and he just tends to throw actual combinations as he's going forward to cling. You know, his game is all built around, I am going to whirl at you like a multi-bladed death machine, of kicks and punches, and I am going to fall forward into a clinch where I can try to take you down. And if that doesn't work, I'll separate and we'll do it all over again. But it's all, you know, there's no distance maintenance in Benoit Saint-Denis' game.
No, there's very little control or regulation of anything, because he's still fights like a young guy who doesn't know that he's, you know, bound to die someday.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The vigor of youth. How young is he actually? I mean, clearly in his career, it doesn't really matter.
He's only 28.
Oh, yeah.
So he is like really in his prime right now, but he's only been doing MMA for 4 years. And he's also fought like 15 times in those 4 years. Yep. So he's really, you know.
He's all piss and vinegar.
Yeah, he's really kind of in the perfect spot right now, which is the hesitation, is that he's got a ton of power and he has no self-regard for his own safety. So maybe rather than Ilya Topuria versus Volkanovski, maybe the better comparison here is your Whitaker versus Duplessis.
Yep.
You know, that's the fear.
Yeah. I'm with you on all that. I will simply add that there is the fact that this is a southpaw versus southpaw fight to consider. Mm-hmm. Poirier has had quite a few of those. And simply has more of the kind of game to make him comfortable in that. Yeah. Saint-Denis has been facing orthodox fighters for the most part. And really has, I think, a pretty simplistic kind of southpaw game to deal with right-handed fighters. He's got the big left kick. He's got a big left hand. And pretty much the right side only enters the conversation after one of those two things has already been thrown out there with full power.
Yep.
So, you know, Poirier's got a great jab. Poirier is defensively savvy. You actually have to be pretty tricky with your entries and attacks, I think, to consistently catch him.
Mm-hmm.
I won't be surprised if Saint-Denis just comes out so hard that he does shake Poirier up early.
Mm-hmm.
But Poirier, like Robbie Lawler, there is like actually more than enough reason to think that he can weather that kind of storm.
Yeah.
He can stay calm. He can keep his defense tight and continue looking for his own opportunities to come back and change the momentum while staying safe enough not to just get put away early.
Yep.
I just think Saint-Denis is a fairly crude fighter on the feet.
Yes, I think I think the Duplessis Whitaker comparison is a pretty good one here. Really? And
yeah, like, but I would honestly say I think I trust Poirier a little more under that Whitaker kind of crazy assault. Yeah, he's more durable and has better defense. Like, I would never expect Robert Whitaker to be in like a safe position if somebody can trap him against the fence and unload.
Yeah. Really, his early mistakes and his early career learning process as a wild man who loved to come forward.
Yes.
They really taught him how to fight off the back foot.
Yeah.
In a way that Whitaker is, like, he's really honestly at his best still when he's leading and is able to create space and distance where he's not getting pressured.
Mm-hmm.
Even if, you know, he's no longer the same blitzing fighter he used to be, much like Poirier is, Whitaker has not really, you know, He's refined his game in different ways, I should
say. He has not matured in the same way or to the same extent.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
I mean, he, you know, I don't want to, like, say he's not a great counter, because, like, the counter striking he did against, who was it last time out? Paulo Costa. Mm-hmm. Like, the triggers he has for his counters for Whitaker are amazingly smooth. They are some of the smoothest in all of MMA. Just like the left hook that he would catch Costa with, or the counter combo he would catch Costa with after Costa would step in. Just so smooth and automatic.
But he's just not as comfortable doing it.
Yeah, he's just, and it's something where he wants, you know, he wants somebody to come in, throw something, and then try to step back while he counters.
Mm-hmm.
Where Poirier is much more comfortable in the, like, oh, you're going to be pressuring me continually. I will win this war.
Yep.
You know, I will continue. I will find offense from your pressure all the time.
Yep. There's a lot of Robbie Lawler in Dustin Poirier.
Yeah.
It really is. So, yeah, I mean, I share your concerns. It's a timing thing. It's Benoit Saint-Denis having a style which is so aggressive and so impactful that, like, you just could get lucky real fast. Yeah. Or at any point, you know, just if he's tough enough to stand up to the shots that come back at him and he's determined enough. And, you know, like, there's a certain level of confidence and aggression that just sort of blasts right through all the rules of, like, how a striking exchange is meant to be conducted.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason that, you know, a lot of fighters feel like they are getting better at fighting all the way through their career. And are, you know, at their best in their
all the way through their decline, right?
Yeah, they feel like technically you often hear fighters talking about how they feel like they're at their best in their late 30s.
Yeah, look at Michael Johnson.
Yeah.
He is at his best, technically.
And yet, they still lose very, very often to much less technical younger fighters.
Yep.
In part because one of the things that having a long career and getting technically better does is it kind of takes away that, like, brutal, I am here to live by the sword, die by the sword confidence.
Yep.
That wins a lot of fights.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Fearlessness. But yeah,
fearless aggression, especially just being fearless and being hell bent on aggression.
Yep.
It can go a long way in this game. So I'm worried, but I'm picking Poirier.
I am for sure picking Poirier. I just think Poirier is, again, I think while prone to some inconsistent performances, I thought that Poirier looked phenomenal in his last fight, as did Gaethje.
Yeah.
Like, they really were both operating at a super high level. And he really did just get caught with one lovely shot. And taking nothing away from Justin Gaethje, but that was not a performance that made me think, oh, Poirier's lost something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think that shot would have knocked out more durable fighters. It was just a devastating, perfect head kick.
No, honestly, it was Gaethje had a masterful plan for fighting Poirier.
Yeah.
He really did.
And unlike Benoit Saint-Denis, he was controlled and reserved and principled in how he conducted his attacks on Poirier in that fight.
I mean, we've talked a lot about how Gaethje has kind of lost the violence idiot part of his game over the years. Yeah. That the Trevor Whitman training has been, much like we've seen with Rose Namajunas, focused a lot more on back foot, like countering and position and stuff like that. And, you know, you could maybe argue that it will cost Gaethje at some point here soon. If it, it's already cost him in some fights, you could pretty easily say.
Yeah.
But it did set him up really perfectly for fighting Dustin Poirier, in that it really made Poirier come forward and extend himself over and over and put him in spots where Gaethje could then be set to counter as Poirier was dropping back or preparing to step in. And it's just in those, like, those shifting points for Poirier that his game is weakest.
Yep.
You know, if you're pursuing Poirier all the time, then he can do a lot of really good crafty stuff off his back foot. And if you really let Poirier storm forward and control you, he will be in danger, but he will be also extremely violent.
Yep.
And Gagey just made him sort of have to close, just meet that middle distance and go through it backwards and forwards a lot. And that is where Poirier is not good.
Yep. So I expect Poirier to probably get hurt.
Yeah.
I expect it to happen relatively early, and mm-hmm. I expect him to survive and win.
Yep. That's how I see it too. Does help his case too, that I believe this is also a 5-round fight.
Oh, is it?
I believe so. Let me see. Yep. It's a 5-round fight.
Okay.
Which
Poirier's had a few of those.
Yeah. That really helps his odds if he can just survive to see round three.
Absolutely.
You know,
another thing that it no amount of fearlessness and recklessness will help you with. Inexperience will really cost you if the fight goes long.
Yep. Odds here, Poirier is the underdog. Open at plus 132 is plus 183. So bettors are jumping on the Saint-Denis train. Denis opened at minus 147, currently minus 207. All right, that brings us to a lightweight bout, Dustin Poirier, a welterweight bout, Kevin Holland, Michael Page. And
was this like any kind of news before the last few like weeks when it was actually announced? How did the UFC come to signing Michael Page?
It was hinted over the last few months, because what happened, it's really funny and stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Is apparently Page and Bellator both just forgot his contract was going to end. And so he fought Goichi Yamauchi. And suddenly back in March of last year, and suddenly he was just a free agent.
That's very funny.
It is very funny. And then it wasn't long, he was talking like, I'm probably going to go back to Bellator. I like fighting there. They've been good to me.
Mm-hmm. Fed me so much.
Yeah. I didn't mean to be a free agent. And, Scott Coker and all of them were like, yeah, of course we want Michael Page back. But Page was also like, I'm going to test free agency, see what's out there, because I am one, you know. And he was, started talking about the UFC a little, talking about the PFL, talking about fighting Cedric Doumbé. And then it wasn't long, it wasn't long after that that rumors started being heavy out there that the Bellator was going to get sold.
Right.
And I think Page probably, he realized probably pretty quick that it would be best for him to just stay a free agent,
mm-hmm.
and not get in the middle, but not part chain himself to that fire sale. And then he said, I read that he went into the octagon for Cedric Doumbé's last, or into the PFL smart cage for Doumbé's last fight. They called him in to talk about a potential fight with Doumbé at that point. And Page just said that at that point, the UFC really started actually picking up the phone and talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been out there floating around for a while, but for a long time, it seemed very likely that he would end up somewhere else.
It's just funny for the UFC to do a Bellator.
Yeah.
Here's Michael Page. He's now what, 36, 37?
Yeah.
Has basically spent his entire career in Bellator, like mostly just being propped up by favorable matchmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to say that he's not a good fighter, but
he is exactly what you get from for great talent out of smaller MMA organizations. Yeah. Which is honestly it's a great argument for having a robust series of other competitors out there,
mm-hmm.
which is that he has a very difficult, limited crafty game that works really well in a place that is not giving guys a lot of time to scout out or think about how to fight him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you've got like you've got a style like Paige has in a place like Bellator where, you know, he's not champion in Bellator. He was for like, what, 5 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
No, he wasn't even. Lima didn't have the belt when they fought. So he was never champion.
He may have had it in their first fight.
No, Lima had it in their first fight.
Oh, Lima. Sorry. I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yeah.
No, but, that's what I meant. Lima had it in their first fight. Yeah. So he fought for the title, but yeah, that was the one in which
Paige has never been champ over there. So even fighters who were in Bellator for a long time, looking at fights that they wanted and were looking to take, Paige always was going to be an afterthought in that.
Yeah.
But we've seen a lot in the UFC where you get these kinds of guys that come in from other organizations and they might pull off two or three really awesome wins. And then everybody's like, oh, okay. I've now seen you fight people. Mm-hmm. Camps start taking notice and the wins just go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even best case scenario, that's what will happen with Paige. You know?
Yeah, well, I think, here's my projected path. They give him this fight, which, like, this is just an obvious booking. Like, it's fun.
Yeah, it's just a cool fight.
It's just fun. Like, yeah, because the thing with Michael Page is, based on what matchup he gets, there's always a strong potential that the fight will just suck absolute ass.
Oh, yeah.
So in this one, at least you give him some guy who will jabber at him.
Yep.
And there will be antics on both sides. There's entertainment value, even if the fight sucks. And if he wins this is my guess, match him with Stephen Thompson.
Yep, of course.
Expect that the fight's probably going to be ass. That those two guys are going to have an awful staring contest.
Yep.
Hope that he wins, and then boom, manufactured title shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just try to cash out on Michael Page, who is almost certainly nearing the end of his career. While you can strike
with the iron. You do the Ben Askren thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know.
Yep.
It's too bad, really, honestly, that Michel Pereira finally realized that he can't functionally be a lightweight and be a, you know, 6'2", 6'3" behemoth.
Welterweight, because, but yeah.
Welterweight, yeah. Because I would love to see Michel Pereira against Michael Page.
Oh, yeah.
That would be super fun.
That would be really stupid. Although, probably would actually suck. This is the thing.
Oh, yeah, probably. It's
like, what, Michael Page is fun when you give him, like, a bumbling oaf.
Yeah.
When you give him another, like, trick shot guy, they're both just like, no, you. Like, you walk into the crazy thing I have planned.
Yeah.
Happy to have him. Bizarre meme fighter, weird little gimmick fighter that he is. Michael Page, like Stephen Thompson, genuinely does have some skills that make him really difficult for people to beat and figure out. Mm-hmm. He knows how to control the distance. He's super, super accurate.
Have insane, crazy reach.
Just, yes, he does, and phenomenal timing. Like,
yeah.
But these things all really depend on how many stupid decisions is the opponent willing to make.
Yeah.
For them to actually be decisive. As for Kevin Holland, you know, I was kind of like optimistic about Holland. You know, at least having one of the phases where he rediscovers his boxing ability, because I thought he looked quite good against Jack Della Maddalena.
Yeah, I did too.
Phil made the point, and I think there's something to this, that Kevin is probably also just very style dependent.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's probably because he was fighting Jack Della Maddalena that he looked like the boxing version of Kevin Holland.
Mm-hmm.
Just like when he fought a nominally similar kind of matchup in Joaquin Buckley or Darren Stewart. These are like mid-range aggressive boxers. and guys who will, just try to jab their way in and then throw combinations. And that puts them right into a range where, Kevin Holland can hit his jab and find his cool counters and everything. When somebody isn't pressing him into that kind of fight, I think that just encourages Kevin to be the stupid version of himself. When he has to, bridge the distance to get to somebody, he starts winging hilarious power punches. So I expect that's what he's going to do here, just like he did against Stephen Thompson. And it's basically like Michael Page could knock him out, but doesn't seem super likely because Kevin Holland is borderline Chito Vera durable. And that if he can't, that there's a possibility Kevin can push him hard enough to tire Page out. Because this basically happens when somebody is actually able to put a pace on Page. Phil pointed out very wisely that he had his bare knuckle fight with Mike Perry.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Perry had that effect on him.
Oh, yeah.
He was just able to withstand the super accurate counters long enough that Page just completely gassed.
Mm-hmm.
And we Page's know that
game is very much a game of him trying to insulate all of his flaws through distance.
Yeah.
You push him a lot, and most of the things that he wants to do don't work.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I'm going to pick Kevin Holland. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
I mean, I have concerns that Holland will try. He will go that he will try to stand on honor and just have a range kickboxing fight with Page.
I mean, he did stand on honor with Stephen Thompson in that he refused to press his obvious wrestling advantage.
Yeah.
But he did not have a range fight with him.
No, he didn't. It's true.
That would be a whole new kind of stupid. I wouldn't put it past Kevin.
I wouldn't put it past him, though.
He's an innovator in the realm of stupid decisions.
Yeah.
As in everything else, but yeah.
Yeah. So I worry about that. But even with the Thompson fight, he did still actually end up taking Thompson down several times. And he is a very willing clinch fighter. And he is willing to dart in and get in somebody's face and get aggressive and look to make more of a fight happen. That I have to trust Kevin Holland here, because Page can really only have the fight where he is insulated by distance.
Yeah. Yeah. If Kevin can reliably flop himself into the clinch.
Yeah.
That should be an area where he just excels compared to Page.
Yep. So I am going to assume that Kevin Holland wins this, but it's a really good booking, and I would not
fun, just for laughs.
I would not be at all surprised too. Like I say, you have the Askren thing. And we've seen this with other fighters too, where there's just going to be there could just be a lot of mystique about Page.
Mm-hmm.
For UFC fighters who are really mostly focused on fighting other guys in the UFC. Kevin Holland has probably not put a lot of time and thought in his career to fighting Michael Page.
Mm-hmm.
And if Page goes out there and just shows him something that he's really uncomfortable with, we've seen plenty of fighters freeze up like a deer in the headlights. Sure. In front of Page.
Mm-hmm.
He has a style that if you're not ready for it, it will feel really dangerous. It feels very, very dangerous and feels like a very bad move to a lot of fighters to close the distance on Page. So
yes, he relies on it more and has more of a mystique than somebody like Stephen Thompson.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got the sort of sneering Anderson Silva-like attitude. Yep. Stephen Thompson is like that dude. Like you just think Sunday school teacher when you look at his face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The style itself is not enough to command the respect.
Yeah.
Kevin Holland looks at him. He's like, this is a corny white boy.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Page, this guy's a grand master.
Yeah.
That's the attitude. And that stuff does play. Like, that has an effect on how fighters will approach their opponents, for sure.
It really does. So I won't be surprised if Kevin Holland just goes out there and goes full deer in the headlights. But I do have to pick him. Yeah. There are just too many more options.
Pretty much.
Holland can be dangerous in a whole variety of ways that Page just cannot and is not.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it has to be, you know, like Page went, you know, he lost a split decision to Logan Storley, where Storley, you know, struggled to out wrestle him.
Mm-hmm.
Storley is 5'9".
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Holland, he doesn't counter wrestling that well.
That's the other thing. Other than Lima, how many other guys has Page ever fought who were close to his size?
Kevin Holland has a longer reach.
Yeah, and he's the same height.
And he is actually a pretty functional offensive wrestler and offensive grappler.
Mm-hmm.
You know? He's not the best defensive wrestler in the world, but he knows how to get people down and out-grapple them. So you gotta lean to him. All right, odds on the fight. Holland is the favorite, opened at minus 159, is currently minus 129, so his odds getting shorter. Page opened at plus 125, currently plus 117. I hope, you know what? I hope Page just has like three or four really fun fights in the UFC. Honestly, I do. And having interviewed him before and talked to him before, you know, really nice guy to talk to. Nice guy. Nice. He's a good interview. He's a fun interview. Mm-hmm. So I hope he gets a chance to do well in the UFC and has his little Michael Chandler run where even if he loses several fights, everybody's like, oh, this is a really fun thing. You know?
Yeah. We need characters like Michael Page and MMA.
Yep. That's why I say like that he's a great argument for having other competition and smaller organizations that build fighters, because you get much more unique talent out of that
mm-hmm.
than the UFC's constant grinder.
No question. Will they, do you think they will let him bring a Pokeball into the cage?
No, they should though. That was still the most disrespectful thing that has ever happened.
He nearly killed a man. Here's a Pokeball, bitch.
He literally crushed his skull and then threw a Pokeball at him.
It wasn't even like an Ultra Ball.
No.
Just the basic model.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Comes into the fight. He brings the Pokeball with him, throws it, and suddenly Cyborg pops out to fight Kevin Holland instead.
Just clearly like malnourished. He has not been well taken care of. Has a choker collar on.
That's right.
A shock collar.
Kevin try or Cyborg tries jiu-jitsu. It's not very effective.
Oh, man.
All right.
Yep. Happy to have him. Yep. Perfect booking. Like,
yep.
You got Michael Page. Just make the weirdest fights.
I do not think that Michael Page going to the UFC was like the smartest thing for him to do. But if he's going to do it, this is the fight I want to see him do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, if I were him, I would be over at Ryzen, like cleaning up once or twice a year in some big wild spectacle.
Yeah. I mean, imagine if they brought him in, they were like, okay, Sean Brady is your first opponent.
Exactly.
Like, that's the UFC does stupid. Just
or Bilal Muhammad just going like pressure wrestling.
Just no fun. Yeah. Let's just have fun with this one.
All right. Welterweight bout, Gilbert Burns, Jack Della Maddalena. And, this is a real fascinating. I am really wondering whose big flaws are going to get totally exposed here.
Yep.
Because Gilbert Burns, he can absolutely do all the things that Basil Hafez did to Jack Della Maddalena and do them much better. Like, Basil Hafez went out there and would get hit by 3 or 4 huge shots and just ride through it and land a couple big shots of his own and try to take Jack down. And then Maddalena would jump a guillotine or just make some really stupid, aggressive move every time and get taken down.
Almost all of the sequences where Della Maddalena ended up on bottom were preceded by a sequence where he was on top and pretty clearly in control.
Yep.
And then made a positionally sacrificial decision.
Yep. Catastrophic error. Error. And, you know, to Maddalena's credit, Hafez was a last minute replacement, literally came in on like 2 days notice.
Yeah. But I know that that, you know, we were discussing this and I was like, OK, well, last minute replacement. Then you realize, I mean, do you recall who he replaced?
Yeah, but he replaced
a replacement.
Yeah. He replaced Josiah Harrell.
Yeah.
Who was Harrell? It was supposed to be Josiah Harrell replaced Sean Brady.
Sean Brady.
Yeah.
So there is the question, what exactly was Jack Della Maddalena originally preparing for?
Yeah. He was preparing for a wrestle grappler.
I'm not willing to say that the whole kerfuffle, like having it be the end of your camp and then that fight was booked a week after the original date. That can screw up a lot of the kind of rhythm of your preparation and training.
Yeah.
You may just have no idea what to, like a lot of things could go wrong. I am still not ready to close the book on that, on the decisions Della Maddalena made in that fight as being indicative how he will approach every wrestler and grappler. But when you recall that it was Sean Brady that he was nominally prepared for, it does make it a little more confusing that he made so many bad grappling decisions. It's like,
yeah.
How was that your first instinct? Because like if he did that against Sean Brady, he definitely would have lost.
Yeah.
Right? He would have got choked out. Like he would have lost.
Unquestionably. Which is a huge question against Gilbert Burns, because Gilbert Burns can do that.
Oh, yeah.
He is very capable, very strong, very powerful, solid wrestler, and very, very good grappler. The same time, we've talked about this for years, and it's Burns is more comfortable than ever in the octagon, so it's it's more difficult, but the problem is still the basically the same one for Burns, which is that he makes up his mind about how he is going to strike before, like, irregardless of what his opponent is doing. Regardless. I shouldn't use the word irregardless. It's a nonsense word.
Oh, my God.
I know.
You're never living that one down. You're
idiot. Idiot. Stupid.
I also think that Gilbert Burns is probably shot.
Might be.
Like, aside from his locked-in issues, he has looked really bad in his last 2 fights now.
Yeah, that Masvidal fight was not good.
That was a bad performance, and he looked awful against Bilal Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
Awful.
Well, and I think, too, a lot of it is just... It may be there's something specific to that, about, like, maybe he's slowing down to the point that he's just not able to get in on takedowns as easily as he did against, say, Stephen Thompson.
He just looked gun-shy to me in both of them.
Yeah. But he still wrecked Neil Magny with ease.
Yeah, Neil Magny's not going to stop a good wrestler. Like, he just can't.
Yeah, but neither is Jack Della Maddalena.
Yeah, it really is just the wrestling, though. Because the thing is with the striking, Gilbert Burns got much, much better.
Yeah.
And I think it was almost entirely an artifact of him just gaining confidence, like,
mm-hmm.
and determination. And because the technique never got really good.
No, and neither did his sense of what you should actually be, how to strike to approach a situation.
Exactly. That, he never developed a feel for the striking craft. He simply got confident and was taught, like, all the stuff that Henry Hooft taught him is good stuff, but it's like rote Band-Aid mechanics. Like,
yeah.
Okay, so you have no idea what's going on in striking. They're how to put this? They're basic principles. Like, if I'm playing chess, Zane.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to calculate. Like, I have no idea how to anticipate a move. I can't see my opponent's threats. I'm still going to beat some bad players by sticking to rules like put pawns in the center, get all your pieces out, castle your
king. Yeah.
Those are things that save me from having to actually think and, like, engage with the game on that level.
That is the level that I play chess at.
Right. And that's the level that Gilbert Burns was striking at.
Yeah.
And those are principles exist for a reason. Like, those will make you a lot more effective just because there are certain things that you do that just increase your chances of not getting knocked out and of winning. But he never developed the actual feel. He never developed whatever the striking version is of calculating a combination, calculating a variation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And now I think the confidence is going as he ages, as he becomes more injury prone. And it has, he basically looks like he has reverted to the guy who just got slashed to pieces by Rashid Magomedov.
Yeah.
He looks to me like he has fully reverted, because without the confidence, it is once more laid bare that his actual mechanics are just not very good and the feel isn't really there.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me is the question. Is it, how bad is Della Maddalena's wrestling and grappling really compared to how mentally broken is Gilbert Burns?
Mm-hmm.
Because if he's as mentally broken as he's been looking, I think he's there aren't many good performances he has left against people that he can't just immediately outgrapple like he did to Neil Magny.
Yeah. I mean, the reality here is I think I'm going to take Jack. And the grappling is a huge problem, I know. But I just can't trust... I can't trust the Gilbert Burns that fought Jorge Masvidal.
No.
Because Jorge Masvidal was a pretty shot non-threat at that point. And Burns just went out there and boxed with him for like a round and a half. And it was like, a lot of it was just very 50-50. He even dropped Masvidal at one point and didn't pounce on him, just kind of like backed off and was like, yeah, okay, I'll let you up and we'll go back to it. And I just don't think that you can do that with Jack Della Maddalena. Now, at the same time, Jack might go out and pressure himself into a loss. He might throw himself at Burns so hard and so fast that Burns has no choice but to wrestle him, and Jack has no choice but to jump a guillotine and give up position.
But it feels like Della Maddalena should have effective enough range tools that he can stop what reluctant shots do come his way.
Yeah.
And as long as he can do that, I just think Gilbert Burns is he's just shot as a striker.
Yeah. It just doesn't feel, watching him strike, it's clear what he built and how. And it just feels like he's now at a point where, you know, it was great and it was serviceable. It's a bit like Jacare striking,
mm-hmm.
where, like, you know, you saw over the years, like, oh, you know, Jacare has some really functional tools here.
Mm-hmm.
Big counter puncher at times, and really had this like snake like weaving boxing game in his prime, where he would weave into the pocket with like short little Mike Tyson hooks and shoot in behind them, so that you really had to like account for the hooks while he was setting up his shot. And then as his speed started to go away and he got old, like, it just, you know, he became less and less a fighter who could be functionally depended on to hold his own outside of grappling.
Yeah.
And
I think even then, Jacare had reason to actually have like the confidence. Jacare did develop a feel for striking.
Yeah, he did develop one.
He liked it. You know, he liked it. I don't know that Gilbert has ever, he likes beating people.
Yeah, I agree. I think the big thing and the reason that it always seems like Gilbert makes his mind up and then does something, regardless of where his opponent is, is that he doesn't like it. And he's psyching himself up and he's like, okay, we're going to go, you know, jab, cross, low kick.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just going to go. We're going to do it. And we're going to bite down and throw. And it always looks like he's biting down and just making the self-sacrifice decision. Which is why he's always been able to get hit really hard on the counter and shook up. Because he's not responding to what his opponent is doing. He's just making a gamble. So,
yep.
I'll pick Della Maddalena to get it done, but I don't like the pick. Maddalena's, the mistakes he made wrestling and grappling in his last, in that Hafez fight, rather, were just terrible. Odds on the fight, Maddalena opened at plus 107, dropped down to minus 100. It's currently at minus 158. Burns opened at plus one or minus 118. Is currently jumped up. Just in the past couple of days, he jumped from minus 101 to plus 142.
Mm-hmm.
So, big jump there for in Jack Della Maddalena's favor. All right, that brings us to a bantamweight bout, last fight of the main card. Piotr Jan, Song Yadong, and this is a fascinating fight for Jan right now.
Mm-hmm.
At this point in his career. Like, I remember talking to Eddie about after Jan's last loss, and I was saying, like, oh, man, I want to see this fight. And he's just like, man, I just want to see Piotr Jan, like, take a step back and, like, take things a little easier, you know, because he's been going through absolute wars now, every fight out, time after time after time.
Mm-hmm.
And even his own, like, manager has said that he's, like, injured all the time.
Really? I haven't heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this fight with Song Yadong, like, I mean, it's your turn to talk, but
I'm happy to hear you out. I've got,
I feel like it's a fight Piotr Jan is well set up to win. As we saw with Song Yadong in his last fight against Chris Gutierrez, his footwork is not enough.
No.
Not enough for big high level fights. And without that footwork, it's really hard for him to make the best use of the speed and power he has against elite competition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it'll be an interesting challenge in this fight because Piotr Jan, he won't have to chase Piotr Jan.
That's the thing. Yeah.
Jan will come to him.
That's the thing, is that this feels like a strangely forgiving matchup for Song Yadong. It's crazy to be at a point where you feel like Piotr Jan is a forgiving matchup for anybody.
Yeah.
But Song Yadong has, since he arrived in the UFC, he has lost exactly two kinds of fight. And struggled in exactly two kinds of fight, you know? One was completely isolate. That was getting out-wrestled by Cody Stamann.
Yeah.
Hasn't happened since.
Nope.
And he's fought good wrestlers. People have been able to get him down since then. Nobody's able to control him.
Yeah.
And getting him down in the first place is also just harder. That is almost certainly just a benefit of being in that Team Alpha Male wrestling room.
Yeah.
I just think his wrestling has improved. Better instincts, better reaction times, more urgency when he gets put down. The other kind, which he has not done anything to solve, is the one you just described, where he gets outmaneuvered.
Yep.
Corey Sandhagen basically beat him like that. Kyler Phillips, Chris Gutierrez made the fight way more difficult than it should have been by just having footwork. even Julio Arce, like, that wasn't one that was going against Song Yadong, but it was completely nip tuck until he landed the decisive shot. He certainly wasn't running away with it either. So, like, that is Song Yadong's big problem. That's the thing that's going to continue holding him back. And it is not a problem that seems to rear its head in this matchup.
No.
Because I have never... Piotr Jan is... basically a brawler. He's a smart one.
Yeah.
A really crafty and flexible and creative one. But he pretty much has had a war with everyone he's ever fought.
Yeah.
He's an action fighter. He will just meet the opponent in their range. So it just doesn't seem like the footwork's going to be an issue.
No.
And at that point, it becomes more a question of what exactly has gone wrong with Piotr Jan.
Yeah.
And this is one where I sort of, you know, I was talking about this with Phil, and like, that was my big question. Like, how do I explain this? Because Piotr Jan was so good, so obviously good, and has some incredible wins.
Mm-hmm.
And then just, and I think you have to go back through those wins and look at the actual sort of mechanism of how he got to the point where he was able to seemingly out adjust everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I think it's just that he has to out punch you.
Yeah.
Like it seems so crazily reductive. And again, I'm not just saying like Piotr Jan is not just a puncher. He's really crafty, great combination puncher, solid defense, good jab, good hand fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent shot selection, you know, mixes up his targets really well. But I would say that maybe the pinnacle of his career, his best ever overall performance was against Corey Sandhagen.
Yeah.
And really the turning point in that fight is when he just decides he's not going to let Corey Sandhagen reset when he wants to.
Mm-hmm.
He has a bunch of close exchanges with him. And then he's like, okay, I'm just going to keep punching after you try to break away. And he starts hurting Sandhagen.
Yeah.
And despite all the different ways he keeps finding to hit Sandhagen, I think the only reason that Corey, after that turning point, was only able to compete but never actually to get the fight back and on side is that he just didn't hit as hard as Piotr.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it. And I think that's why the fight with Sean O'Malley, he couldn't actually make a decisive turning point happen.
Yeah.
Sean O'Malley can crack.
It's true.
It's sort of why he couldn't beat Aljamain Sterling the second time, because Sterling recognized that in order to get to the point where he would start to just trade punches with people in order to kind of break them and turn the initiative in his favor, he was just going to dump all of his energy immediately to out-wrestle him and prevent that avalanche from getting started.
Yeah.
And likewise, in a very different way with Merab.
Mm-hmm.
There's always, in Piotr Jan's fights, there's a feeling out phase, which is often almost irrespective of who it is, very 50-50. Like, he had a 50-50 round one with Uriah Faber.
Yeah, he tends to try to work initially as a pressure jabbing fighter who wants to test range and just kind of probe at his opponent. And there's not a lot of power behind it. There's pressure though, and he keeps the edge of the pocket. So he's there to be hit, and he's not putting out a lot of big shots.
Yeah.
And the idea that I've seen in the past when he's at his best is that he lures people into throwing, and then he gets to spend time counterpunching and picking people off with bigger counter shots.
Yeah.
And then if he can, he if he can convince somebody to retreat because of the power that he's packing in those counter shots, then he becomes the pure pressure brawler who just overtakes a retreating foe.
Yes.
And he likes to go through all those stages. I have seen, but if you go immediately, if you immediately shell up at him and you don't go through the, oh, I'll throw back at you and let you counter-strike, try to counter-strike me, he will just go straight from jabbing to brawling.
Yeah.
He'll skip the counter-punching phase.
And I always go back to that Jimmy Rivera fight.
Yeah.
Which is a fight where for 70% of it, Piotrjan is actually getting tuned up.
Mm-hmm.
He's getting beaten on the counter. He's just not crafty enough. And what settles it, or more than one point where Piotrjan just says, I'm not going to play by the rules. I'm going to completely overextend.
Yeah.
To catch you with your back against the fence. Just going to shock you with just raw, furious aggression and just go for it. And he hurts Jimmy Rivera twice in the fight doing exactly that.
Yep.
Without those moments, he gets completely outboxed by Jimmy Rivera.
It's true.
So I think really, like, weirdly enough, it's just like a lot of matchups where in Piotrjan's UFC career, where for one reason or another, people either weren't able to take it to him right away or did so in a way that they could not sustain, either because they got tired before he did. He's got a great gas tank. Or because he ultimately outpunched them.
Yep.
He just hit harder than them and they had to back off, and then he took over. And now we've just seen three opponents in a row where that just wasn't the factor. And is Song Yadong that guy? I very much doubt that he's going to put a super pace on Piotrjan and prevent him from getting rolling.
Yeah, I don't think so. And I don't think he's going to out-wrestle him either.
No. Though I think he can probably stop a lot of Yan's wrestling.
Sure.
And not actually get controlled, even if he does get taken down once or twice. On the other hand, I've never seen somebody beat Song Yadong cleanly by just like out-punching him.
No.
Chito Vera couldn't do it.
No, but at the same time, he came close, and so did Vince Morales.
Did he?
They were fights where Song Yadong had a lot worse performance in those fights.
Yeah.
Than people might remember over time, because Morales and Vera both stayed in and just kept punching with Song Yadong.
Yeah.
And kept having a lot of success with it.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that Chito like failed, like he didn't go down in flames in his effort. It's just that it remained a very close fight where both dudes were hitting each other hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
But it doesn't look like the kind of turning point that usually puts Yan in the driver's seat and allows him to actually take over.
Yeah.
He could still knock Song out. He could still just win rounds by landing the better shots. He's a much craftier, more subtle striker.
Yeah.
Song Yadong doesn't have the like rhythm changes, the shot selection.
No.
You know, he's much more like
raw speed and power athleticism of Song that he's depending on.
Much more like Josh Emmett in that way. But it does still look like a fight where Yan is going to like ultimately have no choice but to try out punching a guy who punches real good.
Yeah.
So I don't know. To me, I basically have already ended up picking Song just for fun. I think I would pick Yan as the smart pick and also sort of the gut pick because I just trust his game more.
I'm going to pick Yan because there is a clear process to his game. There is a fight he would like to have and works hard to have. I think Song Yadong is still kind of in a place where he doesn't exactly have a fight he wants to have.
Yeah. He doesn't seem to fully like developed his preferences yet.
Yeah.
He's still maturing. But I will add that part of the reason I did decide to just take a chance and pick Song just before I stop here is the obvious consideration that Piotrjan, these have been incredibly humiliating and frustrating fights for him.
Yeah, he might go out there and try to do something really stupid.
I just don't know where he's at. Like, I just think the Sterling fight alone, like, took a chunk out of his ego. Cause like he was so overconfident coming into that fight and he got humiliated in losing it.
Yeah. It's true.
And I just think that that has also informed his performances and made him, I think he's gotten a little less clever in how he, cause he was always a brawler, but he was a very technical brawler. I think he's become a little less of a technical brawler because I think he does seem to me like he's got something to prove out there more than he used to.
And yeah.
I just think he's feeling the pressure.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, I say Eddie was just like, man, can this guy just like get a real good matchup for him?
Yeah. A gimme would do wonders for him.
To regain his confidence.
Exactly. Yeah. But this isn't a gimme, you know, this is not a gimme.
No, I think it'll be a very nip tuck fight, and there's a very good chance that either guy gets knocked out in a way that they have never been.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Song has been, he's been TKO'd at some point in his career pretty early when he was like 16 fighting in Enbo. He got knocked out by Alexei Pulpudnikov.
Who, he has a loss to Giovanni Moglio, which says lost groin kicks. What happened
there? Probably he landed the groin kicks and got DQ'd, I would assume. Or you would
think so, or was it just part of that rule set?
there's also, unfortunately, built into a lot of commissions rules that if you get fouled and you can't continue and the referee feels like the foul was unintentional or not severe enough, they can call the fight and say that you lost via TKO.
It also said that was from an event called Road to M1. It's possible it was a tournament format where...
So maybe he got kicked in the groin and DQ'd and or he couldn't continue and they had to like...
And they called that a loss?
I don't know. Anyway.
Who knows?
Yeah, it's a tough fight for Jan. I'm picking him because I know the process and I can see ways for him to win against Song Yadong at you know, trying a pretty reactive athletic style.
Yeah. Song's just got the one mode, really.
Yeah. But it is very difficult. Jan opened at minus 152. He's currently at minus 118. Song opened at plus 119. He's currently at plus 106.